the unmistakable sounds of Jim Johnston's entrance music for The Ultimate Warrior. And that's who this episode of the Ring Rats podcast is going to be all about. I'm your host, Ashish Gadvi, and we're here today to commemorate the life and career of one of the most beloved characters in the history of professional wrestling, The Ultimate Warrior, who tragically passed away at the beginning of this month, the next day after appearing on the Raw after WrestleMania. And on that Raw, he gave his last public appearance before his untimely passing, and this was what he had to say during his speech.
Every man's heart one day beats its final beat. His lungs breathe their final breath. And if what that man did in his life makes the blood pulse through the body of others and makes them bleed deeper in something than larger than life, then his essence, his spirit, will be immortalized by the storytellers, by the loyalty, by the memory of those who honor him and make the running the man did live forever. I am Ultimate Warrior. You are the Ultimate Warrior fans. And the spirit of Ultimate Warrior will run forever.
It's spine-chilling and almost eerie now to listen back to that speech. And obviously taking into context what would happen to him the next day, it's become something much, much more powerful than just your average promo. But I've got Swami Barakas and Rahul Thakur, a.k.a. Tux, here with me again today to talk about their memories of The Ultimate Warrior and discuss his career. Swami, could you just start by telling us about your thoughts on The Ultimate Warrior's passing?
Well, like many wrestling fans of my generation who grew up during the late 80s and the early 90s, it's come as quite a shock and, you know, fairly devastated hearing about Warrior's passing. More poignant for the fact that it happened so soon after his appearance on Raw and 2 days after his induction in the Hall of Fame. I think many people wouldn't have thought they'd actually ever see him back in the WWE after a lot of bridges were burnt from numerous interviews and events that he's been at, bad-mouthing the WWE and the whole entire company. I think because it happened so poignantly, because his family was there, his two daughters, the overriding emotion of the things that he said and the words that he spoke on Raw, it really hit home with a lot of people. And I think that's what made it that much more heartbreaking.
Tux, on this last episode of Raw, they did a dedication to The Ultimate Warrior. And what did you think about the episode and how much attention they paid to Warrior's passing?
I think it started off well, you know, with a 10-bell salute and having everyone out there wearing the Warrior t-shirts. You know, it was the right way to go about it. And I thought it would be an entire show dedicated to the memory of Warrior, you know, with the matches interspersed between that. But to be honest with you, I was quite upset with how it turned out, because it literally felt like there were maybe two or three Warrior memory segments where they went over his old matches. I think it was his match with Honky Tonk Man, and I think with Rick Rude in the steel cage. And I think there was one more clip, but besides that, there was literally half an hour to 45 minutes, just whatever happens in Raw every week. And then you'd have a Warrior moment, another 45 minutes, and then a Warrior moment. And then I think they finished off with one more later on. So it wasn't what I expected and what I think a lot of the people on the internet expected, because there was a lot of talk of it being a Warrior tribute show. And all it was just a few clips and the well-done intro bit. But yeah, it was quite disappointing.
So were you expecting a sort of show akin to the Eddie Guerrero tribute or the Owen Hart tribute to commemorate when those two passed away?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought it was going to be. I mean, the internet and even the Raw sort of preview little bit that you get on the WWE website, you know, it seemed like that's what they were going to go for, but it just didn't turn out that way. And it was a letdown, and it was a sad way to sort of commemorate the memory of one of wrestling's legends.
I think one of the many factors that it probably wasn't at the level of the Owen Hart and the Eddie Guerrero shows was one for the fact that he wasn't a current wrestler in the roster and a young one at that, which means that it hit home a lot harder with people that see him week in, week out in the company. And a sudden passing like both of those two probably would have generated a lot more, you know, sympathy and outpouring of grief from fans. For people of our generation, Ultimate Warrior was, you know, such a hero and inspirational in everything he did back in the day. But for today's generation, where people like John Cena and Daniel Bryan are the kind of the key figures, they probably don't have that same kind of emotional interaction to him that we have. So that may have been another reason why they didn't go full hog. But I do agree, for someone who'd given so much to the company, same as Randy Savage, who literally only got a few snippets on his supposed tribute show, there should have been a lot more.
Well, you mentioned Randy Savage there, of course, and you know, I suppose the whole point of Randy Savage not getting 10 Bell salutes is another conversation for another day. But Tux, as we mentioned on the last podcast, the Ultimate Warrior was your favorite wrestler growing up when we were kids. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about your earliest memories of Warrior?
Well, for me, it's, you know, being 4 years old, sitting in the living room of my grandparents' house with my granddad and watching Saturday night's main event and wrestling challenge. And, you know, it was just, I think the thing that stood out about him the most was the fact that he had the energy and almost an aggressive streak. And, you know, he was different to Hogan. Hogan was sort of, you know, he sort of smiled for the cameras and everything, whereas Warrior was more of the badass. And that really appealed to me. And in terms of wrestling-wise, I mean, the match that sticks out, obviously, is the WrestleMania 6 match with Hogan. I just remember having butterflies in my stomach. I was so stressed out watching it. I must have been about 5 years old. And I desperately wanted him to win. I wanted him to win both, you know, to hold the Intercontinental and the World title up at the end of the night so badly. And, you know, when he did it, I almost sort of... cried. I don't know, man. It was just one of those emotional moments. And as a kid, you know, that's pretty epic to have that feeling. And that's the kind of guy that the Ultimate Warrior was. And, you know, he invoked that sort of emotional reaction out of the crowd. And it's amazing to think about it now.
Swami, you're a lot older than us. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about your earliest memories of the Ultimate Warrior?
Well, I only really knew him from the initial stint in the WWE, but a lot of people will know about his early days with Sting as the Blade Runners, and then going on himself in World Class Championship Wrestling as the Dingo Warrior. It'd be crazy to think that name still occurring in the WWE, so I'm glad they changed it to the Ultimate Warrior. But for me, he was the one thing that was, like Tuck said, very different to what your normal babyface character was in those days. You know, the people like Hogan and Hillbilly Jim and these nice, happy-go-lucky kind of guys that come to the ring and, you know, and smile with the fans. He was the antithesis of that. He was a guy that was incredibly built, you know, run with a lot of energy into the ring. Everyone else walked. His music was had a raucous sound that generated so much energy into the crowd as well as his own presence. So it was really different. And I think what WWE were trying to do, they were trying to change the direction of the company more into these kind of comic book character kind of style heroes. And it came at a time because I was a massive Hulk Hogan fan. And I've still to this day, if you talked about Hogan or Warrior to me, I always, you know, go slant towards Hulk Hogan. But it was a big thing for them both to come together during an era when in every single territory there was always that one star, and here in WWE you had two big stars and Randy Savage as well. But you know, for these guys to compete against each other for that top spot, it was a big thing. And so for me, when Warrior first came through, I think the earliest memories that I'll always have is the match against Honky Tonk for the Intercontinental title, because it was obviously a shock, because it was a surprise entrant to take him on. Plus the fact it was they were generating such a big push for him after his stint with Hercules, and it took him on to another level. And then that original match against Rude, who, if anyone talks to me about what's the one feud you remember with Warrior over the course of his wrestling career, it'll always be against Rick Rude. But their initial match at WrestleMania 5, when he lost the belt to him, because you could really see now the style, his kind of ring presence and how he was able to deliver in the ring, even though he was supposedly infamous for not being a great worker in the ring and actually blowing up before he'd actually even taken someone on.
It's interesting you say that, Swami, because you know, there's always rumors that, you know, back in the day, certain guys were worried about working with the Warrior because they were scared that they might get a bit of a rough treatment in the ring. It's weird how it works out, because he had some really good matches. You know, Rick Rude in the steel cage at SummerSlam 1990 for the world title. That was a great match. And it's one of the matches that sticks out in my head. And of course, you know, everyone puts over his match with Randy Savage at WrestleMania 7, which was a quality match. But the thing is that in both those matches, was it a case of him wrestling superior workers in Savage and Rude? You know, were they carrying him? A lot of people would say yes, it was. And, you know, it's kind of strange to think about it, but back in the day, you know, the WWE loved their muscle-bound guys. They loved guys with the, you know, guys like Jake the Snake Roberts, Mr. Perfect, Ricky Steamboat, you know, quality wrestlers. But they never got that push for a world title spot. Tito Santana, man, even him. It's strange to think about, but if you had the look, you were the guy that was going to get the push. And it's also quite harsh to think about, but 20 years later, here we are, And it's still happening now. You're getting guys with the big bodies, you know, the look, so to speak, you know, getting the pushes, whereas the little guys are sort of taking a back seat because they're not the guys that the WWE want to put in the forefront.
Well, the match I think that's really going to remain his defining moment was his WrestleMania match against Hulk Hogan, in which he won the World Wrestling Federation at the time title and held that along with the Intercontinental title, and still is the only person to hold both those titles at the same time. So I just want to know your guys' thoughts on that match and your memories of it, and what you really think is the lasting legacy of that match.
I think the reason it's such a landmark moment in the company was, I think that's probably the first time in all the pay-per-views up until that point that you had two baby faces going at it for the biggest title in the company. There wasn't really anything before that that had any significance for a heel and a heel babyface. The company kept very traditional with the heel and babyface matches. But what it did was it outsourced to the fans a real divide of people. You had the Hogan fans against the Warrior fans, and it was a complete crowd of, and you had an emotional connection to one of those guys. And I think for the company, the whole ethos of passing the torch, which is what the whole match I think was established for the first place, was quite a pivotal moment, especially for Hogan, who I guess had been the top babyface for a good 5 years prior to that match. And for him to pass the belt on, I remember Pat Patterson talking about it once in one of these Legends of Wrestling interviews, where he said it was one of the most emotional moments he's ever felt watching a WrestleMania match, because they'd built up this Hulk Hogan character so heavily, and it was such a hero to so many people. And then for him to pass it on to Warrior and start a new legacy in the Warrior chain was something that was very, you know, an incredibly important moment. It didn't obviously last the legacy of time, because Warrior wasn't quite the guy that everyone expected him to be in terms of putting the company over in his profitability. But the fact that it was two big baby faces taking each other on, and you've seen since then Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Rock and Cena so many times now, it's become very, very common. But at that time, it was something quite revolutionary.
That's very true. It was definitely revolutionary. And, you know, I was hoping that it would spark a revolutionary run for the Warrior as the champ. In his time, he had the match with Rude and the Survivor Series 1990. I loved the fact that he was there with the Road Warriors, the Legion of Doom, and the Texas Tornado in that main spot. And it was such a cool thing to see. And, you know, I, at the time, being a kid, not knowing, thought, you know, oh, this man's on fire. He's on a roll. This is going great. But then, you know, he dropped the belt to Sergeant Slaughter at the Rumble, who eventually dropped it at Mania 7 to Hulk Hogan. And I think that outlined the facts of what was going on then. And it was the fact that Warrior was not the bankable guy that the WWE wanted. He wasn't the Hulk Hogan. You know, Hogan's spell for 5 or 6 years, it was amazing. And like you're saying, Swami, they wanted to pass the torch on to Warrior and hope for the same sort of thing, to replicate that. But it didn't happen. The worst thing as a Warrior fan for me, looking back at it, is the fact that Warrior had such a small stint as the champ, and not even a champ, but as in a pure top line player. I mean, Hogan got rematches time after time, and rightfully so, considering the money he made for the WWE. But I really wanted that long 4 or 5 year run for the Warrior, you know, dropping the belt, winning it back, having some feuds here and there, and then getting the belt again. But it's so sad to think about a legend like the Warrior not getting the opportunity, you know, just winning it, dropping it because of the financial issues. And it just all went downhill from there.
Yes, downhill indeed. And that's kind of where all the internal problems started for the Ultimate Warrior within the WWE as well. And these are obviously quite well-documented problems now, but relationship between him and Vince kind of started to go really sour from that point onwards.
I think all the problems really culminated at SummerSlam 91, where allegedly Warrior was practically going to no-show the main event based on contract issues and a certain amount that he was supposed to get and didn't get in the end. And I remember Vince was saying that he would give him the amount for the just to perform at that event and then fire him immediately after the pay-per-view had finished, which is what pretty much ended up happening. The thing was, they were actually building up towards a feud between Warrior and Jake, or Warrior against Undertaker, with all those vignettes. And that didn't materialize either. And I think by then, up until that point, both parties were in a position of playing hardball with each other. Vince wasn't really not going to akin to Warrior's demands. And I think that was the beginning, the end, and everything just ended sour from there.
Well, after he left with all of these problems, he did come back for a short stint in 1992. He stayed for around 6 months and then left again, unfortunately for him, due to allegations of steroid abuse. But he didn't return to the company until 1996, where, you know, he was involved in some decent work, I would say, during that time.
Yeah, I mean, when he came back, I mean, the first thing he did was he beat Triple H in about 10 seconds at WrestleMania 12. And, you know, it looked like they were going to give him a push. And also, you got to think about it, at the time, WWE were getting their asses handed to them by WCW in the Monday Night ratings war. So I think WWE were hoping that they could get a big name back to sort of chip in, help out in the ratings. And not just that, but they were a bit thin on main eventers. At the time, you had guys like Yokozuna and Mabel taking the big spots against the likes of Diesel and Shawn Michaels. So I think that might have been the aim. But to begin with, I think obviously there's a Triple H match. The Goldust feud was a good one. It was quite interesting because they were very different characters. But the thing about those two was that they were characters. You know, it wasn't just two straight-laced guys going at it. It was two guys with different types of edges to them. And that was quite interesting. And even towards the end of it, Warrior was rubbing shoulders with the likes of Michaels and Bulldog and, you know, the top guys at the time. I think the WWE were thinking about a long-term push, but obviously that fell flat on its face.
Yeah, again, it didn't seem to work out for Warrior again in the WWE. But, you know, during that time, it has to be said that I personally really, really enjoyed his feud with Goldust. I thought that it had a really good psychology to it. It was built up properly. And, you know, it was a good feud between, you know, two people who'd been around for a long time, you know. And in Dustin Rhodes, I think he had a really, really good worker as well. So, you know, that was definitely a highlight for him at the time. But, you know, again, as you say, Tux Warrior left the company. And, you know, this is where things really took a turn for the strange, because he then appeared on our televisions again in WCW.
Oh, man, strange is the word to use in this equation here. When he came back in 98, the leader of the OWN, the One Warrior Nation, with Ed Leslie, the disciple, a.k.a. Brutus Beefcake, with him, it was the strangest TV you'd seen in a while in wrestling. It was just very odd. He came in, and obviously, in terms of wrestling and running around, I mean, the guy struggled even more than he did in 96 in the WWE. He came back for controversial reasons. A lot of people say, including the Warrior himself, said that he came back purely because Bischoff and Hogan colluded in a way so that Hogan could get one over him, so it could be a one-all sort of thing in terms of wins and losses. But in all honesty, that was, like you're saying, very strange. I mean, the whole smoke thing coming out of nowhere, and then Warrior appears in the middle of the ring and disappears. And as a fan, a big Warrior fan at that, you know, it really outlined something new for me about the Warrior, in that he was a bit of a wacky character. It's something I didn't realize in his first tenure in the WWE or his second one.
Well, as you said, you know, as Warrior fans, you know, in particular with me, when I first heard that Warrior was coming back to WCW, I was actually quite excited about it, thinking, oh my God, it's Warrior, he's back, you know, let's see what WCW will be able to do with him. And even if you go back and watch the video of him coming back onto Nitro, he gets a really good pop from the crowd, you know, he was still very loved by that point. But I think the problem was with WCW that they were just stacked with talent at the time, and there just wasn't enough room for everyone. And as you say, with the rumors with Hulk Hogan and him coming back just to appease, you know, Hulk Hogan's ego in terms of getting one back over him, it never was going to end particularly well for Warrior at that time. And I suppose that brings us on to that encounter with Hulk Hogan, which Eric Bischoff claims was one of the worst matches in professional wrestling history.
Oh, look, WCW wasn't akin to having some of the most greatest technical matches during both of those companies' runs at the time. You know, a lot of those the prime players were actually past their prime. Hogan coming towards the end of his tenure, Warrior was in his late 30s, Randy Savage, Piper, so many people during that period. And it was just a cacophony of madness. Some of the storylines that were being concocted, the numerous kind of title changes, it ended up being quite a circus. So Warrior against Hogan was only one of the very many matches during that period that you could have labeled under some of the worst matches in WCW history. But I just feel that, you know, it was a publicity stunt, him coming back then in the first instance. It started off well, but the longer that his time period went on in the company, it just became quite nonsensical.
Well, post leaving WCW, the only real connection we had to Warrior was just hearing kind of crazy stories about him on the internet, on the blogs and things like that that he did, airing some rather controversial views most of the time, some views that which should probably be condemned in today's society. But he also badmouthed the WWE on quite a few occasions, which I suppose made it all the more surprising that Triple H actually reached out to him in the first place to get him involved in the WWE 2K14 game and subsequently getting into the Hall of Fame, which, you know, brings us full circle, really. So I just want your guys' thoughts on what you'd really like Warrior to be remembered for and what your main highlights of his career was.
For me personally, I just think the Warrior will always be remembered as my childhood hero, you know, the one that stood out the most. It'll never leave me, and I'll always love him for that. You know, the best memory I have is WrestleMania 6 when he won the world title. It was an awesome occasion. And just in terms of how he was, I'll always remember him as the man with unbelievable amounts of energy and passion and even aggression. Just coming down to the ring was fantastic to watch. So I'll always have fond memories of him, regardless of whatever the negatives may have been in his life. You know, a lot of love and respect for him.
Yeah, I'd agree with a lot of what Tux has said. You know, Warrior's legacy for me would be something of very much a uniqueness, something that was very, very different to anything that was coming out that era. You know, it was during the golden age of wrestling where there had so much colorful characters and, you know, so many kind of weird and wacky people in and out of the organization at any one time. And Warrior did present something that was very much original. It was a character that's touched a lot of people. I think he'll be remembered for that fondly now rather than controversially, which is what a lot of his last 10 years have unfortunately manifested to. But ultimately, you've got to look at his presence and his figurehead during that time of the company as something that was quite unique, quite amazing, and one that will stand the test of time for as many generations to come.
Well, for me, and what I really love about wrestling from that period, I think my highlight of his career, apart from the matches that you guys mentioned, is the vignettes he did with Jake the Snake Roberts during his feud with The Undertaker. And for those of you who aren't familiar with them, definitely go check them out on YouTube because they are absolutely awesome, just television gold. And in closing, we've obviously lost a really great character from our childhoods, a great wrestler, and overall just someone we'll remember for years and years to come. So this last one goes out to the Ultimate Warrior. Rest in peace and safe journeys on that spaceship back to parts unknown. Warrior.